2010 Wikivolunteer Insight Call, and this is where we try to discuss challenging problems in the data center. And this is Dave Vellante, and the topic for today is the future of data storage. And we are pleased to have at least one of the two luminaries on the call today. Steve Cicola is here, and Richie Larry is going to be here shortly if he's not already. For those of you who don't know Steve and Richie, Richie is very well known storage architect, as Steve was saying, you know, one of the originators of the HSC 50 and early digital storage works contributors, and Steve as well, who is currently the CTO of Xiotec, and Richie is a fellow at Xiotec. Steve's been a fixture in the storage business for slightly over three decades, I think I just heard.
That's right.
You were also very instrumental in launching StorageWorks.
Especially the EVA and all that kind of good stuff.
You've worked on some very challenging problems. You mentioned some of the things that you were doing with Seagate, and we're going to talk about that. And I think between you have something like 70 patents that you're holding.
Yep, you bet.
And by the way, I'm here in the Marlboro offices with our good friend John MacArthur. Hello, John.
Hi.
And Stu Miniman is also here.
Hello.
And so if you're going to tweet this, pound Wikibon, it'd be great. *6 to unmute and mute your line. Everybody's welcome to participate. So we're going to have a little conversation Steve and perhaps Richie up front. Let me just say that Cicola will challenge many of the commonly believed conventions in the storage business that have become popular over the past decade or two. And there were a few issues we wanted to discuss today, and more if we have the time. But the first is the notion of drive failure rates and this notion of that Steve started to talk about of removable devices. And the problems that can potentially cause some customers. And then the second is ways to achieve balance and consistent performance, really from the perspective of the applications. And then we're also interested in these guys' thoughts on the future of the dual controller architecture and disk controllers in general. So again, Steve, welcome, and thanks very much for coming on the call today.
You bet. And Richie, hopefully you're out there. If not, you're getting on. So
so maybe you could start by, let's address this. So I've seen research conducted by Schroeder and Gibson at Carnegie Mellon. Google has also published a lot of data on disk drive annual failure rates. And they suggest this data suggests that that these AFRs are significantly higher than what you'd expect from vendor spec sheets. I think the Carnegie study was something from like 2 to 13%, and Google's data showed something from almost 2 to almost 9%. So I guess maybe we can start there, and you can help us understand why the discrepancy between these manufacturer claims and field results and anything else that you want to share with us.
I will. Okay, so as far as it goes, you know, when I started doing, you know, storage works and things like that, we really only had maybe, you know, 20, maybe 40 drives behind an array, and we weren't really interested in much in terms of scale because people weren't scaling data that much. But by the time we did the EVA, we started running into a lot of weird problems with respect to the traditional data shelves, which were mandated by marketing, not by engineering. We wouldn't have done it that way because vibration and cooling and just the scale and how they failed and all the possibilities for failure with how you do reliability became a real challenge. In 2002, we looked at things and said, you know what, when I went to Seagate, we looked at things and said, you know, these failure rates are just, you know, we know what the drives are designed for. We looked at historical failure rates and how drives really failed, and we said, you know what, the traditional shelf model, or worse, where people put drives on cookie sheets are awful. And not only that, the majority of failures are really not failures past the normal failure rate of drives, unless you kill them with vibration and cooling. It's actually bad software that calls out drives erroneously with that famous word, no trouble found. And as much as there's been a lot of studies out there on drive failures and stuff, and now there's been a lot of papers out there saying the cloud is going to suffer from drive reliability, well, that's because the typical model is to just jam more and more drives into things with no regard to the, you know, the physics of cooling and vibration, let alone the software to deal with these little control systems, which are not meant to be dealt with except, you know, very carefully. You know, they're very interesting devices with lots of information that comes back that people don't necessarily use. And one thing I will say is that thing called SMART is pretty much a last-ditch effort by the drive to tell you it's about to die. And there's a lot more to be done. And in an array controller today, probably less than 5% of the code is anything to do with error recovery because the mantra is, when in doubt, throw it out. So we challenged that by building a system that was meant to be reliable. And I think the thing about it is looking at the problem completely differently. What if you wanted to not ever have to do service? How can you save money on a solution? Because if the drives are actually designed to be reliable, which they really are, you can actually make them last a very long time, and hence all of the work that was done at Seagate with the, you know, pretty much the, all the people that Richie and I have worked with for the last 30 years, that from DEC and Compaq, et cetera. We all left HP, et cetera, and went to Seagate in 2002. And
okay.
Basically, 2007, we went to Xiotech to get this to market.
So tying back into some of that hard data that mm-hmm. was published, and there's more than just the Carnegie study and the Google study, but it's pretty
right.
dramatic. You know, substantially higher AFRs. And so I guess from an end user's perspective, share with us why that matters. I mean, people say, hey, with protection schemes like RAID,
it matters because of like at least three items. One is any kind of a failure is a disruption, because people have forever said, hey, if I lose a drive, okay, I've got RAID, it's going to protect it, but what's that do to the application? While it's fixing itself, you've lost performance. That doesn't have to be the case. And the second thing is, you're paying for a service warranty because the model is, when in doubt, throw it out, even from the software perspective, because 85% of all drive pulls out there are no trouble founds. And the rest of them happen to be, you know, wear related or things with vibration or cooling or premature, because really, really, drives are designed to have a very small AFR. And what we've been able to do is challenge that with the technology we built, which was give the devices a better environment, no matter if they're hard drives, SSDs, et cetera, and basically make it so you avoid having to do service. Because
right.
if you can do that and you change the AFR.
Richie,
go ahead. Yeah, go ahead.
A lot of the failures that wind up being no trouble found are actually the drive becomes mismatched with its environment, which is why
Correct.
When the drive vendor brings it back and puts it on in a better environment, they show up no trouble found.
Correct.
We, because of some cooperative code between us and some of the drive vendors, are able to, if you will, recalibrate the drive to its environment. And the reason it matters. Go look at the numbers for RAID, and you start looking at what the probability of double failures, et cetera. The reliability of a RAID set is proportional to the square of the reliability of the drives. So if we can get a factor of 2 in reliability out of the drives, we get a factor of 4 in reliability out of the RAID set. When we originally started this effort, the statistics that we've gotten from Seagate on their returns and you know, us basing what we thought we could eliminate as failures, said that we'd get about somewhere between a factor of 2 and 2.5 in the reliability of each drive, and I believe the field data we're actually exceeding that.
Right, we're exceeding that, and then the other thing we did, this is where we come back to fundamentally challenging, because we, you know, Dave, we talked about the fact that you save money by not having to do service. And if you can maintain performance by, you know, working around failures or not having failures in the first place, that's a really good thing for a business, because they can be consistent. But when it comes down to what we did, if you look at how array controllers have been dealt with today with a dual array controller with many, many drives, it's exactly like the model of a horse and buggy with like 100 range or 200 range or 300 range to all these drives. We changed the model to use groups of drives as a single unit. That changes how you do reliability modeling. It changes how the drives work together, which we did, and it leads to a magnitude greater avoidance of failures. And then add to that, we actually can map around pieces of drives like a meta level bad block replacement. What we've got today, and really, really, we do have this, and there'll be stuff coming out in the press, et cetera, you know, our failure rate after 5 years is about 0.1% of what we call these data packs that hold multiple devices. Today we use multiple kinds of hard drives, whether they're 7.2K nearline drives or enterprise 3.5s or enterprise 2.5s, and we'll be adding SSDs, et cetera. The point is, the model of grouping things together and treating them as building blocks allows you greater scale, not only with respect to performance, et cetera, but also for service avoidance and much higher reliability.
So let me just make sure I'm getting this right. So the data that has been published suggests that the annual failure rate, let's see, vendor spec sheets would imply what? Less than 1%, right?
Correct.
And then the actual data in the field, we're seeing anywhere as high as, you know, the low teens.
Yeah.
And then you're saying that your results are demonstrating an order of magnitude lower.
That's avoidance for a group of drives, for a group of drives. Our failure rate is about, you know, somewhere between 0.4 and 0.6% per drive. But when taken as a group, as they work together, because we have many, many patents that we developed at Seagate, which one of the reasons why we're not at Seagate is a political one based on other vendors wanting to make money on service, was that this fundamentally challenged the fact that you have to remove drives, and it drives a lifetime of drives that is much greater than 3 years, and in fact, the theory shows somewhere between 7 and 13 years, which no one's ever kept stuff in service that way, but it leads to people at least being able to change how they buy and keep storage for much greater than 3 years. The five-year time frame becomes important then.
Right, and that wasn't as important, let's say, 6 to 10 years ago, because in fact, at that point, drive density was doubling every year. And your drives actually were obsolete before they wore out, but you know, the disk technology is pushing up against some fairly fundamental limits, and we're down to about 20 to 25% a year growth rates in capacity. And so, in fact, keeping those drives longer is a much more viable strategy.
Well, David Floyer actually did some research on the average age of a disk array that's installed. David, am I correct that you found that it was close to 5 years?
Well, 4.7 years was the actual average, which is longer than its actual useful life. A lot of
right.
that due to the fact that it takes so long to replace them.
Right. And I would say that beyond that, that leads to the other part of this, which is money. Once again, if, you know, normally any array controller out there has a max warranty of 3 years, or you have to buy it, but the fourth and fifth year service, they really get you. And this technology that we're talking about, if you change the way you look at things and you do things in groups and you challenge things and do things, the technology can play to your advantage where, you know, using commodity parts but thinking things differently, you basically get, you know, at least a five-year life. And, in fact, that's why we offer a five-year warranty, you know, directly. It's very interesting to look at that, because then it leads to everything else that's past reliability, because reliability is something that people kind of just count on because they say, well, RAID covers it. But RAID doesn't cover the fact that you're paying maybe up to 15 to 20% of your list price for a service warranty and then getting to pay the entire amount over again for the fourth and fifth year.
Okay, now just to be clear, you have proof. This is not theory, right? You referenced.
Oh, this is proof. We have almost 3,500 of these things in the field, and we actually proved it before we were sold from, spun out from Seagate to Xiotech, because we had spent $100 million to develop this, just like a disk drive. We had built 700 of these things, ICE units, in a lab that was over $20 million to basically prove this. And then now we've been in the field for over 2 years, and we have the proof, not only with any kind of drives. I mean, it's very interesting as you look at drives. They are not things that people might say, you know, just die on the vine, whatever, because those reports are very erroneous, because they lead you to believe that you should just throw things out, because it's not that way. The drives are better than that.
The drives are better, is Josh, by the way. But the famous RAID article from Katz, Patterson, Gibson was published in 1988. Mm-hmm. At that time, 3.5-inch was 21 megabytes, and MTBF was 50,000 hours.
Mm-hmm.
Today, fiber channel are 600 SATA 2 terabytes. It is 100 times more capacity. Mm-hmm. However, the MTBF improved by 20 times.
And that's only at a SATA drive. That's only at a 30% duty cycle as well.
Yeah. So there is something bad with that arithmetic. I mean, the RAID 1, RAID 5 are not valid anymore. I have customer who last year lost lost three times two discs in weight 5, for example.
And
he lost the second disc in the time of the rebuild of the first one.
And now the question is, was that a real failure, or was it a software issue that caused the drive to become unreadable based on the environment or
for
how the software did it?
For the customer, he doesn't care about that.
Agreed.
He lost data.
Right. Well,
he lost data.
Agreed. Go ahead, Richie. Right.
And the thing is that I strongly believe that the time of RAID 1, RAID 5 are finished.
Mm-hmm.
RAID 6 will be used till the end of the decade, but in my point of view, in the middle of the decade, we will see triple RAID or the clustered RAID.
And I think we actually use a form of clustered RAID already inside of our device. The whole point, though, is to make the drive more reliable so that you prevent the failures in the first place, because they can be prevented. What you're talking about is the fact of traditional shelves and traditional boxes with how they traditionally deal with things. Traditional RAID doesn't work anymore, I agree. But traditional packaging doesn't work either. And that's the issue. The whole thing is people have come to believe that drives are basically, awful, so when in doubt, throw it out. The software is going to say the drive is bad way earlier than it really is bad. They're not going to take the time to take a look at it, even though the drive
right.
is actually better. Go ahead, Richie.
And you're also pinched by the other thing that's happened over the last 20 years or so, which is drive capacities have increased by a factor of 1,000. Drive performance,
almost 100,000.
Oh, and from the 80s, I'm talking about the 1 to 2 gig drives that you could get around 1990, 1991, versus the 1 to 2 terabyte drives you can get.
I'm talking from the
performance is only gone up by a factor of 2 or 3.
Right.
So in fact, we're lucky that people are putting a lot of data on the drives that they never access, because the whole system would come to a halt. Unfortunately, people are also interested in high functionality storage to do things like snapshots and CDP, et cetera, which actually exact a very high cost in performance, and RAID 6 exacts a high cost in performance. It is about those 50% more IOs on a write than RAID 5. So the there's different kind of currencies that you can pay in, but performance is becoming an increasingly critical issue, and a lot of things start to hit performance at the same time. It's a cascading effect. If you have RAID 6 and then you start implementing snapshots or periodic snapshots for CDP, you all of a sudden find that your storage system's pretty slow.
Can I just clarify the data that you just shared, Richie? So since 1990-91, drive capacities have increased 100x in the performance of devices.
Actually 1,000. In 1990, I'm pretty sure I'd have to go back and look.
Right,
in 1990, we had 1 and 2 gigabyte 3.5-inch drives.
You're right.
By the end of the 90s, we were up to about 36 gig, and now we're at 1 to 2 terabytes.
Right. Okay.
Right? But the drives in 1990 were 54 and 7200 RPM. Their seek time was 8 to 12. Milliseconds. You know, you're fighting the laws of physics here. Now we've doubled the rotation speed and more or less half the seek time, and the drive is slightly more sophisticated three-dimensional optimization than they have a seek queue, but still you're getting a factor of 2 to 3
right.
in performance,
and I guess
for 1,000 times as much data.
For the gentleman talking, we advocate the right RAID for the right kind of device. The bottom line is, if you can reduce the
Welcome
failure
to Verizon
rate, you can
Wireless.
Reduce the
chance. The wireless customer you called is not available at this time. Please try your call again later. Announcement 1/22-10.
It's impossible to hear.
Welcome
this
to Verizon Wireless. The wireless customer you called is not available
Something
at this time. Please
call,
try
guys.
Your call again later. Announcement 1/22-10.
Okay, as I was saying, we fundamentally believe in whatever the RAID that's desired, and we actually use a clustered kind of RAID inside of our groups of devices. So the right kind of RAID gets used, but we're talking about fundamentally saying you shouldn't have to remove a drive because they're not going to fail the way you think, and they're not going to. We can prevent them from failing in the first place. That so the data loss becomes basically almost a non-issue. I mean, certainly disasters can occur, but this is about taking things from a level of, you know, up to 13% down to 0.1% in 5 years. That AFR is much less than 0.1%.
So
it changes the rule completely.
I want to open it up to folks a little bit. Are there anybody want to chime in and weigh in on this out there? I'll just give you guys a chance to ask these guys some questions.
Hi, Dave. It's Mike Versace from Wikibon. Hi, guys.
Hi.
You mentioned this earlier, but I wanted to go back on. Actually, I had two questions.
Mm-hmm.
You know, all the new services that storage provides now, encryption, thin provisioning, compression, dedupe, single instancing, snapped, all of that new, that's all new software, right? So
mm-hmm.
What impact do all of those new services, storage-level services, what impact do you think they have on some of the historical failure rates and drives?
Well, I mean, you're using the drives more for sure. It depends on where you win and where you're using them and what kind of drives. It may, because I remember duty cycle plays a big thing with any kind of drive, and especially with systems that are more prone to your traditional shelves have a real vibration problem with respect to multiple workloads across the drives simultaneously. It really is a mess. I mean, especially with the white boxes and stuff out there, I've been at many, many customers that have even put, like, they couldn't believe it. They thought they were just, everything was supposed to be the same. And they put, like, a, you know, a screw. Last week I was at a customer, and they put a screw inside of a white box with, like, 30 or 40 drives, and they couldn't believe it. The vibration was so bad, and they wondered whether performance was an issue. Yet
so
they bought it for really cheap.
So do end users have to think about drive failure rates as they think of turning on these storage services?
Yeah. They should think differently about storage in terms of it. Go ahead, Richie. Go ahead.
Yeah. The link between storage functionality and failure rates is really an indirect one. As Steve said, there's a duty cycle issue, which matters a lot more if you're using SATA drives, because
right.
they're just not tested and rated at the high duty cycles. Enterprise drives are rated at 100% duty cycle. The question is how much performance do the features soak up versus how
mm-hmm.
much performance is available for the application. We've done some testing on this. If you have a competent array controller, there's a whole class of them out there that does snapshots. When you take a snapshot, the capability of that array controller to extract performance from the disk drives drops by about a factor of 3. And the reason it does that is that when you take a snapshot is done with smoke and mirrors. It has the appearance of an instantaneous copy, but actually what happens is that the first time you write any spot on that volume, the storage controller has to copy out the old contents to preserve those old contents in case you want to actually access the snapshot. And so what was one write operation turns into a read of the old contents, a write of those contents somewhere else, and then your write can proceed. As the snapshot ages, the writes that are read that are accessing parts of the disk that have already been written, they run at full
right.
performance. The number of writes that go to new areas of the disk drops down over time. So what we tend to see is a fall off of about a factor of 3 in performance, and then a slow climb, kind of a logarithmic climb up to, in 15 minutes to 2 hours, you're back to 80 to 90% of the baseline performance of that volume. However, now throw CDP into the mix, and you're taking a snapshot every hour. You're actually not even letting that curve come back to the 80 or 90% again, hitting it with another snapshot, and you're down to a factor of 3.
Well, or your traditional array controllers where people schedule snapshots every so often, it's basically the same thing. It's never getting back to normal.
So, Richie,
the issue there is, again, how much spare performance do you have? How much headroom do you have above what your application is currently using?
Mm-hmm.
And how much of that headroom do the desirable storage features, because these are great. Snapshots are a wonderful thing. CDP is a wonderful thing. It not only protects against drive-type data losses, it prevents against all the logical data losses, viruses, and application screw-ups, et cetera. You know, it's a valuable thing. It's not free, though.
Just one quick follow-up. This is Mike again.
Hey, Mike, I just want to, before you go on, so one follow-up with Richie on the comment. I noticed in the Google paper that they said that there was not a high correlation between activity and annual failure rates, and I believe they were using both serial and parallel ATA drives. Are you familiar with that
study? Yeah, Google uses almost exclusively ATA slash SATA drives. There was a Carnegie study where they said, well, we didn't see a difference in MTBF between the enterprise drives and the desktop drives. However, if you read into that study, there's some built-in selection bias, which is if you use a desktop drive appropriately, right, then, in fact, it will have the same MTBF as an enterprise drive if they're rated at the same MTBF, because using it appropriately means respecting its duty cycle limitations.
Yeah, so horses for courses. The Google study specifically indicated they could not find a correlation between activity and annual failure rates.
Well, and I can only say I don't want to. The interesting part is packaging still plays a big deal. Vibration, they've beat up their vendors very hard on vibration, yet they choose to put things in packaging that does nothing to prevent vibration, let alone crosstalk across drives and heating issues. Those things will kill drives over half the time in terms of the overall failure rate of a drive that can really fail hardware-wise.
Right.
So those are things that people just assume they're just going to be the way they are, and these papers don't take into account that information. Therefore, they're making judgments based on insufficient information.
Right. So, Mike, a lot of people on the call, I wonder if you could hold your question just to see if anybody else has any other issues they want to explore with Richie on this topic, Richie and Steve on this topic before we move on.
This is David Bruce from Accord Consulting near Toronto.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm wondering if you could comment on how you would logically group fan appliances into latency classes. So, for example, what would be an economic point, a performance point for SSD versus spinning drives or storage appliances that might benefit also from this grouping of drives, whether they be SSD.
Okay, let me take that from an architectural standpoint. Today we already have three classes of storage that we provide that in groups we call them. In our technology they're called data packs, and each data pack has a quality of service that you can, you know, gang together by your traditional methods of, you know, striping or whatever to get more performance, et cetera, and doing disaster tolerance with mirroring, et cetera. We do that with nearline drives, 3.5-inch 15K and 2.5-inch enterprise drives. You can logically say that when they're ready, we're going to be doing things with SSDs as well, so you'll have different classes of performance, and it just depends on what the application wants to be and how you analyze the app for what it needs. And the software aspect of analyzing applications is kind of like one of those things that's out there now and being done by a lot of people externally as well as by us from our storage. We analyze what's going on and what we see. I think that's the way it needs to be. That's if you group these things together, because first of all, if we solve the reliability issue, then you can start, you know, making some more assumptions about what you do above, because then, you know, you're taking care of things at a different level, and it changes the complexity of the solution and reduces the cost. And after that, you can start getting into how you group them.
Okay, so I appreciate that. What do you suspect is a reasonable inflection point for a switch over to an SSD, a pure SSD SAN, for example, such as the Whiptail device? Or do you think that strictly spinning drives would meet all but the high-performance computing and supercomputer types of requirements?
I can kind of take that. I mean, right now, there may be some applications that require, you know, nothing but SSDs, and in fact, companies like Texas Memories, et cetera, have been making money off of those niche markets for quite a while. But there is still a pretty forbidding cost difference. You know, the cheapest you can buy kind of consumer-grade SSDs, and that's where really most of the action is in that market, because in notebooks, they really are going to be displacing disk drives in their entirety over the next few years, simply because disk drives have gotten too big.
Right, and they're going to be gluing them down in netbooks. They're going to be gluing them down in netbooks.
Disk drive for 100 gig of SSD, and the pricing looks a lot better. But in the enterprise, you know, you're still faced with a floor of about $2.50 to $3 a gigabyte for the raw SSD devices, which is actually a fairly small markup over the cost of the flash itself. And for spinning disk, if you want low performance desktop class disk, you're under 10 cents a gigabyte. And for enterprise stuff, you're in the 30 to 40 to 50 cents a gigabyte. So there's a significant cost penalty, and I think what that is going to dictate over the next several years, that it's not an either-or question. It's a mixed question.
Well,
how do you build hybrid systems with both solid-state and spinning media?
Exactly.
And
there's
get
that.
The performance advantages of the solid-state and the cost advantages of the spinning media.
And that'll be a key. And now, one thing I didn't say, guys, and this is one of those things that has to do with fundamentally changing the rules. As much as we change the reliability by grouping things together, once you start grouping things together, there's always been this bashing thing to say there really wasn't much of a performance difference between SATA and enterprise drives. Well, we have the proof out there, and we're willing to share it anytime. It's also evident in our SPC numbers as well, that we get twice the I.O. per drive at the application level as anybody else gets from their drives. And
I guess going back to an earlier question, is that grouping dealing with temperature and or humidity and vibration?
Yes.
All three? Yeah.
And all three. And that is, by the way, one of the ways in which we get performance. Modern drives are very sophisticated, and they will work around vibrational problems to ensure that the data is correct at the expense of performance.
Correct.
They'll do it by holding back writes if they are not absolutely confident that they're on track and letting
correct.
The drive go around again until the heads settle down a little more before performance.
And it happens so much in these large boxes where they jam a lot of 2.5-inch 10K with the white boxes or appliances, and it's like people don't even think about it because they assume. And we've shown the numbers to be true. Not alone, we've also changed the firmware and the drives to work together like pistons in a motor, so we get absolutely all the performance out of a drive that's theoretically possible. And that is one of those things that you got to say, there is a difference between an enterprise and a SATA drive. There is
Richie,
no question.
You said something that was, I don't want to let it go by because it was nuanced, but it's important. You said 2x the I.O. per drive at the application level, or maybe Kiva said that.
Correct.
What do you mean by that? Can you elaborate a little
bit? Because everybody can do benchmarks and stuff, but it has to do with when it gets to the application of how they really do their patterns and how the drives get work with respect to queuing and making sure nothing gets slow and all these other things. You know, Richie and I and our team have been together for over 30 years and doing this where we could change the assumptions of how the devices can work together, let alone, you know, make them last a long time. We actually have been able to prove this, and obviously with this technology that we came out with has 84 patents associated with it alone.
And the results show up in things like our Microsoft Exchange test numbers.
Yeah, 20,000 users on Exchange with 40 drives, that's pretty good. And let alone number one in SPC and multiple things, and we haven't even published our numbers on 2.5-inch drives just because we can hold off, because it has to do with how much money you're paying for your storage and how effective it is at I.O. density. You know, SSDs will have really killer, you know, I.O.s, but not necessarily the density for the price. Not yet. That's why there's going to be hybrids for a long time.
Now, for a certain category of data, at the individual application instance, isn't it all about latency?
Oh, at some level, sure, and it depends on
how
they solve
it. For some applications, the more you get into TP-oriented applications, the more it's really about throughput. The more you get into some of the scientific stuff where actually IOs start to become synchronous, you know, you've got a big matrix you're inverting, it's too big for memory, and you're kind of paging it out to disk, the more latency becomes important.
Yep. So you kind of get both. We work in both worlds. We work on the latency side. Obviously, we're doing, you know, network connect today, but the architecture of such a device that groups together devices to get the maximum out of it is what we've gone forward with, and there'll be many more things coming out in the future as we go forward with this, because it fundamentally changes a lot of the assumptions on how people have treated storage and wrote software around them. You know, it becomes, what if the cloud had reliable storage behind it and didn't have to suffer from issues of scale that would kill it otherwise, with respect to reliability and having to throw things away. Plus, it's, you look at the green factor, throwing away all these drives, people shred these drives, think of the mess this causes based on how many drives are out there that are basically getting thrown away because they can't return them because of security issues.
So didn't you guys sort of start this whole dual array controller trend?
We did. That was
20 years ago.
Heavy.
So,
yeah.
So could we talk about that a little bit? I mean,
sure.
What do you see as the future of that architecture?
Well, I mean, Richie, I'll start. You follow up, okay?
Yeah.
Well, for me, I like to. What we did with what we've done is we've moved a piece of the array controller. You look 20 years ago, the SCSI disk came about by moving a piece of the array controller, which was all the hard stuff that Richie and all the guys and me did all the stuff to control sector and index pulses and abstracted it away by putting that piece of hardware in a drive. And a lot of people at the time said the drives were going to get more expensive as a result, whatever, but we got the API, which allowed us to do RAID. With what, you know, and then of course the dual array controller came into existence because people wanted to have high availability at a lower level, and we started moving things out of what used to be in the server and all that kind of stuff. Today, what we've done is move the lower end of the array controller down into really close to the drives with our group technology. So there's actually HA at that level. I see the dual array controller, you know, going away towards the world of like either clustered virtualizer heads or appliances or NAS heads or just software sitting in hosts that's clustered that can deal with the volume management. I guess, Richie, go ahead.
Yeah, there's been two models to build an array controller, right? There's the big box, the walk-in freezer style,
yeah.
And then there's the little
box, which
tends to be two independent controllers that fail over for reliability, et cetera. And when all this started in the 80s and 90s, the big boxes were really able to get the kinds of performance that enterprises needed because the processors weren't available to stick into the small box form factor. Well, you know, Intel has taken care of that problem and other people. And you can now pretty much get as much performance as you want out of a controller that fits on a single PC card. So the difference in hardware functionality between those big boxes and small boxes in terms of their performance is largely gone. And of course, the software, you can run the same kinds of software in either box. One of the things that we've done in this controller that we hadn't done in any of our previous efforts is that one of the issues with the small box controller has always been that because the two halves of the controller run independently, they each have their own idea of how to optimize the back-end performance. And unfortunately, when they both start accessing the same disk drives, their ideas conflict, and since they're not communicating, you actually lose performance on the account of this guy's trying to yank it to the inner tracks, and he has a bunch of requests to do there. This guy's trying to access to yank it to the outer tracks. Their requests kind of interleave at the drive level, and the drive does a lot more seeking than it's supposed to. So in this generation of controller, the technology was available for us to put a high-speed, low-latency bus between the two controllers so that they could act as a cluster in certain areas, and specifically around optimizing the performance of the back end. In the past, you could either partition the back end between the two controllers, which always causes some kind of a waste of performance as you get imbalances, or you just let them both rip on the same set of drives, at which point they're kind of fighting each other in terms of their seek optimizations. Now they cooperate on the back end, and they all hit the same set of drives, which is one of the tricks we use to get the performance numbers we get.
And that's the part of how it is with the RAID controllers. The dual controller model always had that trouble. And
the big boxes did not have that trouble.
Right.
They just had the trouble. They just had the problem that they were big boxes and very
right.
expensive.
Well, one thing that needs to get noted here too is history. When the SCSI disk drive came out, was around the time that things like Windows and Linux came out too, and people wanted to get away from proprietary vertical solutions with the big Unix boxes and wanted to go, and that's when NetApp came out in the 90s, et cetera. A lot of the features that you now see in, say, VMware or Windows or Linux or other people's software solutions and Symantec and all these other people have now grown up. Therefore, all these features that are down in the array controller are kind of like misplaced. they need to be closer to the application. Therefore, one of the things that we focused on is automating the configuration of the features with right-sized application chunks of storage. If you change, that's another way to change the model, and I'm moving the ball here a little bit, because that says you don't really need a dual controller. You just need to have some level of DAS or network storage out there that's easy to, you know, tie to whatever feature you want to run with it, whether it's dedupe or clustering or snapshots at the host level, VMware doing their own thin provisioning, all this kind of stuff. That leaves the storage able to be much more of a linear device instead of, like Richie's statement, where a snapshot starts causing all kinds of non-linearity in the performance by having those features in the storage itself. You got to fundamentally look at how things are, and what we've done, instead of saying using individual disk drives, use drives in a group. They work together. We move that piece in there so that they work together. You get the maximum performance. It already has HA and data protection and reliability, and now you can deploy them in chunk sizes that basically let you build up on a system from one to zillions with simple management methods such as REST. Okay. That's where things, I believe, need to move, because otherwise you can't scale without, you know, people today are using volume managers on top of big iron, just because the big iron, they can't use all those features in them anyway, because it makes the performance a mess when they try to virtualize their mission-critical apps.
So you're talking about envisioning a simplified storage infrastructure where the application is more in control.
Exactly. We want the application is what should be in control. It kind of got out of sequence back in the 90s and early 2000s because, frankly, the apps didn't have much features. But you look at Oracle with ASM. You look at, you know, all these other people, they have a lot of features and stuff. VMware has a lot of stuff. Hyper-V is going to add a lot of features, et cetera. A lot of this stuff is going to move away from the arrays.
So that actually brings up a lot of questions that I have. But, again, we have over 100 people on the call.
Go ahead.
I'm sure people have an opportunity to ask these
questions. Go for it, guys.
Go ahead, folks.
So doesn't that actually bring up the question of what features belong in the storage array?
You're absolutely right.
Can I ask who that is? Just your first name, if you don't want to give us your whole name.
Mark Dayan.
Thanks, Mark. Go ahead.
Well, I mean, for me, I'm always the one of, you know, put the right features in to match with what should be done at the host. I mean, Richie mentioned that putting snapshot in an array actually causes some really weird things to happen linearly with performance. If that happens to level up, I believe that, you know, for me, you should provide the base reliability and data integrity inside of the end storage device, the thing that you attach to, and that would basically be whatever RAID's appropriate for the type of device that you've got, which, you know, and the groupings, et cetera, and provide volumes, et cetera, to be able to do it and make it simple to manage with very, very simple APIs that are web-based, because I believe that the storage should be manageable just like software. So features would change, features to augment setting up file systems, features to help move data around without having to move data through servers, things like that. Those are more base-level features than just putting every feature in the planet from disaster tolerance to replication to dedupe, because that stuff exists everywhere else.
Right. I mean, there are some features which can exploit the power of the mirrored write-back cache in a modern controller, which is an extremely low-latency memory that you can stash data. And, in fact, snapshots, for instance, are one of those. Although, by the way, the factor of three that I was talking about, drop-off in performance, was measured on array controllers that do provide that write-back cache. It's
correct
if they don't. But in general, most functions, and by the way, the interesting thing is that SSD, in fact, provides an intermediate tier of storage between that write-back cache and the spinning media, and is going to reduce the importance of exploiting the write-back cache in the controller for certain features.
Correct.
But most features don't benefit that much from the controller's write-back cache, except secondarily, which is that the disks that they appear to be accessing are a lot faster. So the question is, where do you want to manage the complexity of some of these high-level storage features? You know, whether you want to do it in the very constrained programming environment that is inside all array controllers, or whether you want to do it in the richer software environment that is available in a dedicated appliance or a host operating system.
And that's where I come back to saying the applications and the operating systems tied together and the scalability can be done at that level. And if you do it with reliable storage that gives you linear performance, whatever you want to use it for, latency or IOPS, et cetera, you can solve the scale problem finally without having to make it cost too much.
So you're saying manage the storage in Oracle, VMware, Exchange, maybe other apps, SAP mm-hmm. perhaps.
Yep.
Okay, again.
And lead to automation. It's basically about automating your environment. I mean, people have so many names for cloud, grid. We used to call them big clusters, whatever. I mean, for me, it's like nowadays it's like you got so much, you just want to automate it. And the simplicity of automation comes with making everything a little bit more linear. And what Rich Ritchie's talked about is a lot of the nonlinearity in storage that's kind of gotten, I'd say, into a large fur ball in the last 20 years and gotten really bad in the last few. Because the OEMs are still trying to push selling
all
these features.
And the other issue that you have, especially with what I was calling the small box controllers, is each feature that you put in a small box controller is limited in its scope to the drives that sit in back.
Exactly.
Okay, because everybody implements snapshots slightly differently. Everybody implements DT's disaster tolerance slightly differently. Everybody implements dedupe slightly differently. And in fact, if you have a storage system that spans multiple controllers and need to coordinate the disaster tolerance function, the snapshot function, the dedupe function, etc., across these, the implementation in the controller actually gets in your way because it's got blinders on.
Exactly.
It only works on the stuff that one controller
yep.
controls.
If
your applications volumes are striped across multiple of these controllers for performance, you actually can't get there from here in terms of the features.
It's like, you know, you go back to like our the CEO of Xiotech, Alan Atkinson, was the first guy to deploy basically SRDF in the world at Goldman Sachs. And he did it because there wasn't any integration in any software anywhere, and he needed disaster tolerance solution. He was desperate. And nowadays, you can do this with software at a host level, and you didn't have to worry about coordinating with the storage. Why bother? Why buy that license?
Well,
because
not
it only spans with things.
You can do it with software at a host level that coordinates the
exactly.
The
therefore,
storage.
These features...
Of the virtual machines.
So that's why we went back to fundamentals. You got to solve the base problem because otherwise you're building on a foundation that is so teetery. It's no wonder that people like Google and others started putting out papers that said failure rates are so awful. What do we do about this stuff? If you went back to the fundamentals, you could solve problems and then rescale and do things differently and save a lot of money.
So this is John MacArthur. I just want to ask a question as to functions that should be in the application layer versus in the storage device.
Mm-hmm.
Things like deduplication, which is really hot today.
Yep.
Are you saying that should be at the application level?
Or an appliance. I mean, I think that's a lot of times it depends on when you want to do it. A lot of people do their mission critical data direct, and then after the fact, they mine that mission critical data to find the duplications. It depends. It depends on what customer. Because I've seen, obviously, Richie and I have seen inline dedupe as well as we've seen, the appliances. Comments, Richie?
Right. I mean, the successful deduplication has in fact traditionally been tied into backup.
Yep.
Right. So there's something that actually really does kind of belong in the backup application or the backup appliance, depending on who you're talking to,
yep.
right? Online deduplication right now is a flag that people are trying to chase, and I don't think anybody's captured that flag yet.
Yeah, I'm not sure. I'm not so sure about that one. But
nearline deduplication, the way, for instance, NetApp does. Applications are transparent to it, but in fact NetApp makes use of the fact that it's running the file system. It owns the file system and the knowledge associated with the file system. And from a storage controller's point of view, that is an application.
Mm-hmm. Yep, it is. And I think other features inside of the host would be, you look at Oracle. Oracle has a clustered volume manager. That's a really nice thing because that's the top end of what used to be big iron array controllers. That allows you to scale. You know, Storage Foundation is still, Symantec Storage Foundation is still one of the big ones. Linux has a great volume manager. Those are applications that are nicely put in the host, and they're finally getting some use. I mean, this is how you build something without having to buy big iron or big software that might be sitting in a switch, because you're just having more places for data to get, latency issues on it.
Okay, we have about 8 minutes, so
okay, and I guess there was a couple other things in terms of management, storage management, I'd like to kind of bring up, if you don't mind.
Yeah, I just let me just open up one more round of questions if we can.
Go ahead, go for it.
Hey, this is Larry Freeman from NetApp, if I could ask a question.
Sure.
So it sounds like we boiled down to two topics here. Number one is stop failing drives when they're not really bad, if it's a software error or something due to cooling or vibration.
And prevent failures in the first place of real failures.
Sure. And the second thing is to try to prevent hotspots so you're not beating, you know, a small number of disk drives to death.
There's a lot more than that, but that's one aspect of it, yeah.
Well, those are the two major ones I heard. Is there something else of them which is most important?
Okay. I'd say they're all important because they all lead to the efficiency of storage. If you can get twice the IOs out of a drive, as well as, 1,000 times less prone to making a replacement of a group of drives, you've saved money in two aspects of storage that haven't been tried to save money in the past. Those are huge.
Okay, one other question, and then we'll let Steve wrap.
Okay.
This is David Flyer. I just want to go back for a second to the whether Flash is going to introduce very different ways that data is going to be used. If I look at my wife's iPad, it gives incredibly good response time and with a pretty small processor chip there. Isn't the whole way that applications are written and the amount of data that's going to be accessed change a lot of the metrics that you're basing your assumptions on?
No, not to me, because Flash can fail many more times differently than a drive can for failure rates. So failure rates still have to be observed because an SSD is in effect like SSDs. If you just use raw Flash as memory, that's one thing. But an SSD is essentially an array controller from 10 years ago. Richie mentioned 1 and 2 gigabyte drives. If you go back to 10 years ago, we were at 4 gigabyte drives. If you look at the guts of any kind of SSD, it's an ancient array controller that has basically brand new code in it. So that's very interesting. But in terms of fundamentally changing or possibly changing things, in terms of how apps, I don't know about fundamentally, you're going to get more performance and apps are going to change to meet those things in the future. But
we'll use them, utilize them, yeah.
Yeah, but like, it's a matter of being efficient. Go ahead.
Certainly it's true that the less asynchrony in an application, the more it's a synchronous application, and pretty much every application on an iPad and most applications on a notebook are synchronous, at least from you, the user's point of view, which is you're waiting for the results. Those applications are going to be more natural candidates to replace spinning media with Flash. The database industry, if you will, has gone to great lengths over the last 30 years to eliminate, in highly parallel applications using the transaction processing paradigm, to get out of that latency trap by, in fact, trading it for throughput.
Right.
And that's the whole idea of transaction processing. The work of a transaction occurs with a single log write, and then all of the database updates that would normally have to happen synchronously for the transaction to be acknowledged all occur in the background, become throughput issues, not latency issues.
All right, so Steve, you wanted to mention something on management.
I just want to bring up the fact that, I mentioned before, storage should be managed like software and applications are managed. However, to date, the storage industry has done things to try to make the management of storage be a completely separate entity from that of the applications or the infrastructure, et cetera. And you look at how cloud is working and everything else, the ways that people use things with HTTP and HTTPS over something called REST is an opportunity for not only automation, but the final integration of storage with the applications. and we have moved very quickly into this regard, and now we note that it's very simple. We've got an open API that lets people do things with respect to cloud or their own infrastructure automation, let alone it's made it so simple to automate provisioning for VMware, Citrix, Hyper-V, whatever, all these different things, that I don't, it's going to be interesting to see how the storage world moves, because it's been stuck on SMIS for a little while versus this thing called REST, which is a completely web API. And I would stress people to take a hard look at that, let alone we've opened up this API, which is the first one of its kind, and it's out of a, you can get it to it on a website called cortexdeveloper.com. It's very interesting from the standpoint that most applications use web services, and now many of them are starting to move towards RESTful services. So I would urge people to take a look at that. It's a different way to manage storage, just like the web is managed today.
Excellent. Okay. So we're pretty much out of time here. And on behalf of the Wikibon community, I'd really like to thank Richie Larry and Steve Cicola from Xiotech for joining us on the call today. We heard a lot about technology that is available to dramatically lower annual failure rates. We've talked about sort of new architectures that really shift the responsibility for managing storage to the application, depending upon, I guess, the function level. We talked about sometimes appliances are the right place. And then got a glimpse, a very interesting, sort of maybe non-traditional glimpse of what the future of storage might look like. So thank you again, Richie and Steve, for coming on. We really appreciate it.
Thanks a lot.
I also want to thank the other Wikibon members who contributed today, David Floyer, Josh Krischer, good to have you on, Mike Persace, thank you, David Bruce, Mark Dayan, and Larry Freeman from NetApp, thank you for your comments and questions. And as a reminder, over the next 24 hours or so, we're going to have up on Wikibon 6 research notes that pertain to this call, and we'll have user action, so look for those, and feel free to hit the edit tab and improve the pieces. I mean, after all, it is a wiki, or put up your own piece, or even write a wiki tip. We'll also be producing a podcast of this call, which Dave Butler will be putting up on the website very shortly. So thanks for listening today, everybody, and thanks for being a Wikibon member. Bye for now.
Thanks for having us.